Thanks for joining us. We're at WTUL New Orleans 91.5. We're just cutting short that counterspin to welcome Dr. Elmore Rigamer to the studio. He's here to talk to us a little bit about single-payer insurance. First, I want to present this public service announcement. It's brought to you by the Department of Public Safety and Corrections, Division of Probation and Parole, and WTUL New Orleans. Employers, you can help reduce the recidivism rate in New Orleans by employing formerly incarcerated individuals. Steady employment is an important factor in successfully reintegrating back into the community and avoiding reoffending. Federal and state funds may be available. More information is available by phone. Their number is 504-568-8738. And again, welcome back to the studio. Today it's me and I'm Nora and Janet Hayes. We're welcoming Dr. Elmore Rigamer, medical doctor and Masters of Public Health. Am I right? Dr. Rigamer, is a medical director for Catholic Charities, the Archdiocese of New Orleans, where he currently directs several disaster relief programs for the victims of Katrina hurricane disaster. Rigamer received his training in psychiatry at the New York Hospital, Cornell University, and Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. He received his MPA from Harvard University. Prior to joining Catholic Charities, Dr. Rigamer served the U.S. Department of State as medical director, advising the Secretary of State on the international health issues while overseeing the health care of Foreign Service diplomats and their families. He also served the U.S. Department of State as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Medical Affairs, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Mental Health, Director of Mental Health Services, and Regional Psychiatrist for Europe, the Soviet Union, and South Asia. Dr. Rigamer has also held positions with the Kaiser Permanente Health Maintenance Organization and the Ochsner Clinic, as well as served as a Peace Corps volunteer physician in Monrovia, Liberia. So, Janet and Dr. Rigamer, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nora. That's quite the biography, Dr. Rigamer, and we're so happy to have you in the studio with us today. So, we've been following the single-payer healthcare issue for a little while, and actually one of your co-chairs, Dr. Rade Pajek, was in about a month ago to discuss what a single-payer system in the United States would look like and what things would need to be in place for the United States to adopt a single-payer system. Now, you've traveled all over the world, so you have some experience in looking at other at single-payer systems and other developed first-world nations that have single-payer plans. What's your take on the difference between how other countries administer healthcare as opposed to the United States?
I guess the biggest difference is how we see healthcare. In almost all industrialized countries and countries in the developing world, healthcare is seen as a human right. We do not look at it like that in this country. There's a debate among people whether healthcare is a right or is it a commodity. Do you get healthcare guaranteed to you, like public safety is guaranteed to you, education, clean air, security? Or is it like tomatoes or Mercedes? You get what you can pay for. That's a harsh view of healthcare as a commodity. If you look at other countries, let's stay with the industrialized world because it's more comparable. They have universal access to healthcare. Healthcare costs much less than it does in the United States per capita and as a percentage of gross domestic product. And it's really hassle-free. We know here in the United States it's hard to access care. It's very difficult to understand your bill. Personal bankruptcies at the top of the list as a cause were medical bills. And now with the privatization of the public health system, people going into the public health system unemployed or on assistance are going to be billed. And if they don't pay their bills, I would imagine that's going to show up in their credit reports and have some consequences for when they apply for credit or for a job. So let's go back to the other countries. There are a couple of principles that all of these countries show, their systems show. And as I say them, you can think of where the rub is here. You want to understand healthcare about how it's organized, how it's financed, and how it's delivered. That's, I think, a good conceptual model to look at any any healthcare in any system. All of these countries, there's a universal mandate. Everyone has to pay. Everyone has to belong. And there are subsidies for those who cannot pay. So everyone has healthcare. The health system operates within limits. So insurance companies cannot make profits, and insurance companies must accept everyone. Now they do here. And then physicians and hospitals, and this is important, physicians and hospitals must accept one set of fixed prices. So there are global budgets for healthcare. It doesn't creep over into other sectors of the economy. It doesn't threaten to money from education or defense or things like that. If we keep going the way we're going in a few years, healthcare will be 20% of our GDP. And in other countries, it's 5, 7, 11, 12%.
Yeah, and in an op-ed that you wrote recently, a couple of months ago, you mentioned physician burnout is high. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you know, yes, physicians here are bedeviled by the bureaucracy of the healthcare system, regulations to some degree, but particularly insurance. Physicians spend in this country about 20 hours a week on bureaucratic tasks, as opposed to 2.5 hours a week in Canada. They spend four times more on billing and insurance-related overhead each year than their counterparts everywhere else. The figures I have, we spend about $82,000 per physician on overhead. Canada, it's about $22,000. So it's significant. Now, why is this so? Because there is a tremendous amount of profit in healthcare, particularly the insurance companies, the device makers, and the pharmaceutical companies. This can't take, it doesn't take place in countries that have universal healthcare because of the limits that I said. Now, universal healthcare, one of the first reactions is it's socialism, you know, and indeed it's not. Germany, for example, is like Medicare, or Medicare is like Germany. You have a payer, you have insurance companies working under contract with limits to administer this bucket of money. Canada, I guess you would say, is, not Canada, maybe a better example, is the VA is like the United Kingdom. All of the means of production, buildings and people, are owned by the government. So there are many different ways to ensure universal access with the market at play. It doesn't have to be totally socialist like the United Kingdom. It can be like Germany or France or Canada.
And I am actually from Canada, so I can attest to that. My health care plan consists of a card that says I was born. I have a social insurance number, and that little card that says Alberta Healthcare entitles me to health care for the rest of my life. Right. I can walk into any hospital. I can get emergency treatment. I can go to my primary. Now, in Alberta, primary doctors did implement a copay, but I think that's gone away now. And also, you know, in the United States, I did apply for Obamacare, and I was with Blue Cross Blue Shield, and my contract with them was about the size of a phone book. And honestly, I didn't even read it because I think I need a lawyer to interpret it for me. So we've talked a little bit about the economic costs of not having a single-payer system here. What about the social costs? When you look at recently we had the Ebola scare. There was very little interest by pharmaceutical companies in researching or doing research to come up with a vaccine that would treat Ebola because it was a one-time thing and they couldn't see that they would be able to charge repeatedly for vaccinations. Mm-hmm. And so the government, you know, the government is sort of atrophied in terms of how they deal with these sorts of epidemics. So if someone gets sick, I mean, if they don't have health care, obviously they're going to be negatively impacted and perhaps they may die. And we all, you know, in the United States, there is this attitude of this dog-eat-dog sort of world where everybody's out for themselves, and there's not really an understanding of community and the health of the herd mentality. What's your experience?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies, I don't blame them. They act as they should. They are for-profit, publicly traded companies, and their fiduciary responsibility is to give a profit to their shareholders. So they're not doing anything illegal. It doesn't make sense to develop a product for which there is a very small market. And that's where you come into drugs for esoteric rare diseases or things like Ebola. There has to be a place for the public sector to do that type of thing. Now, incidentally, the public sector spends a lot of money developing, researching and developing drugs for the pharmaceutical companies that they hand over to the pharmaceutical companies. And it's because of that that the pharmaceutical companies have an enormous profit margin. They have about a 17% profit margin compared with 3% of profit for all other industries on the Fortune 500 list. But let me get back to your first point, is what happens when you're sick and you don't get care. We have a lamentable system. The clinic I work in at the Daughters of Charity, you'll have people without insurance. So they do not have money to buy medication for the illnesses that are common in New Orleans, diabetes, hypertension. They come to our clinic or other clinics, federally qualified health centers, and they get care, but they can't, oftentimes they can't buy the medication. A lot of them go to the emergency room. However, once they get enough complications of diabetes, like losing a foot or going blind or having a stroke, they become eligible for disability, and then they get Medicaid and disability. How ironic, huh?
Yeah, it's a shame that you have to get really sick before you get it.
Now, think of the expense, but again, this is what's so frustrating about our healthcare system. The money is being spent. It's just how it's being spent, for what I said, how it's financed, and how this finance is organized. And so there's a tremendous amount of profit in the U.S. healthcare system. And that's why it's going to be quite difficult to get to single payer. Because, as I said, the sectors of the healthcare establishment, pharmaceuticals and insurance companies, to some degree physician payments, but not a large amount. But it's a zero-sum game. If we have universal health care, you have to have the principles that I mentioned earlier, you know, and that's just not going to happen. There's a lawyer at Harvard School of Law, and he's done a lot of research on campaign reform. And it's startling when you realize this, but 0.01% of the population, contribute more than 60% to the PACs, the political action committees. And if you look at the legislation that they favor, 95% of the legislation that they favor will be passed, in contrast to a very small percentage of legislation that we public citizens support. So when we elect an official to represent us in Congress, it's unlikely that that person is going to represent us. Because the force of lobbyists are so strong in Congress. They're more than, three to four lobbyists for every congressman or something like that. And congressmen spend 50 to 70% of their time in office on the phone raising money to get reelected. So, you know, it's pretty interesting what was happening in Hong Kong. The people of Hong Kong demonstrated against the Chinese government dictating who would be on the ballot for them to vote for as governor of Hong Kong. It's not any different here. You know, who gets on the ballot in large measure is determined by who pays for the candidates that they want. Now, why do I say that is because single-payer system, while it's rational, will be a tremendous upheaval. People will lose money. There'll be a lot of people in the there won't be much of an insurance industry. So people in the insurance industry will lose their jobs. And that's difficult, you know, and they will find work other places. I'm sure it'll sort out as the healthcare system evolves, but that's one of the obstacles.
That's a great segue into my next question. You're listening to Dr. Elmer Rigamer. He's currently medical director for Catholic Charities Archdiocese of New Orleans, where he currently directs several disaster relief programs for victims of the Katrina hurricane disaster. Do you see a possibility of the Affordable Care Act transitioning into a single-payer system, or would the entire system need to be scrapped and we start over?
There are two thoughts on that. The opponents of the ACA fear that. They feel that we're opening the gate to universal health care. And I'm sure that's at the basis. A government-controlled system, which is a pariah to them, I'm sure that's at the basis of their fear. The Affordable Care Act leaves a lot to be desired. There is a lot to be desired. Now, we have almost had universal health care in this country about five times in the last century. And it's lamentable that we lost it at each point, sometimes by big supporters like Ted Kennedy holding out for negotiating something else. But so you have people who say, look, we got to do it incrementally. And that's what the Affordable Care Act represents. Others, like the Physicians for a National Health Program and Dr. Waldhandler and her husband at Harvard and the New York University, they believe, no, this is the wrong way to go. It's giving the public a bad idea of what government-administered health care is. And as we know, there's some people who aren't insured, the people in this donut hole, like Part D, but it's a, you're making too little to get insured. Copays in the plans vary, so people can't afford some of the copays, whether it's for the visit or the medication, so at least a lot to be desired. However, with that said, you have 27 million people that got insured, huh? And you have people that can't be refused by a company for a pre-existing condition. That's an enormous benefit. You also have people who were staying with their jobs because of insurance, and now they can get insurance. The insurance is portable. So there are many benefits. I don't think the public will stand for it being totally repealed. I think it's gained enough traction. Look at the surge in enrollment. Unfortunately, it was almost glitch-free. But like you said, it's very, very hard to understand. In other countries, you said it, you have a card, huh? In this country, just think, Don Barrow gave this beautiful example. He's was former president, founder of Institute of Healthcare Improvement. And he said, just think of riding the metro and you had to get off at every station to get a different car to go to the next stop. That's what our health insurance is like, and that's what it does to us, the payer. You know, it may or may not be covered. You got to call for this or that authorization. It's so complex. But there's money to be made in the complexity by keeping the public in the dark.
Right. I think what you're getting at is that we have health insurance, but we don't necessarily have health care. And also the issue of deductibles, the what you mentioned, right, costs for pharmaceuticals or drugs post care, and people just if you have a $100,000 heart attack and your insurance company covers $80,000 to $90,000 of that, you still owe $10,000. And not many people have that kind of liquid income, right, to be able to spend even $10,000 on a medical emergency. Or, there are other examples I could use. And so they get credit cards and they put it on the credit card. And the next thing you know, they are in bankruptcy. They have a poor credit rating. And the poor credit rating leads to other problems. And so it is incredibly complex. Now, you mentioned Physicians for a National Health Plan. The acronym is PNHP. They're on Facebook and they also have a website. And you also mentioned Dr. Waldhandler. You're a member of PNHP. There's a chapter in New Orleans.
Yes.
Where can people go to find more information about
this
issue?
Well, you can go to the website, pnhp.org, okay? And there are fact sheets. And it's an organization open to anyone who is interested in healthcare. It's not restricted to physicians. And they believe in incremental progress. They're constantly chipping at it. They ask us as members to do what I'm doing now. When you have a chance to talk. Write letters to the editor, write op-eds, talk to your friends. Because I'm convinced if the public really understood it, if they really, really understood it, I believe there would be more of an outrage and an outcry and demanding something better. But unfortunately, they don't. I have sometimes when I speak to business groups, I begin the lecture about saying, private insurance, commercial insurance costs about 20 to 25% to administer. What do you think Medicare costs to administer? And inevitably, I'll get answers anywhere from 25 to 40 to 50%, because the feeling is, if it's by the government, it has to be inefficient. Medicare, I wish they would spend a little more money on anti-fraud, but Medicare costs 4 to 5% to administer. Why? Because none of the money's going to the other places that I said. It goes
right.
to the healthcare.
It's not being siphoned off by an administrator.
So healthcare is expensive here because we have the highest rate of we spend more to administer our hospitals than any other developed country in the world. We spend 25% of our healthcare dollar to run the hospitals. That means that's money not going to healthcare, as opposed to 10%, 11%.
Right. And I think in terms of galvanizing support, I don't know if there are any statistics that reflect the sentiment in the country right now about single-payer healthcare, but I can tell you that everybody that I've spoken with, and I'm on Facebook as well, want to see something like that happen. I think people that do understand, especially because of the internet, and they now have access to all kinds of information. They're able to, they have a window into how other countries do things. And I think, I know for the, you know, when you look at campaign finance reform, the majority of people in the country, I think it was in the high 80 percentile, want big money out of politics. But it's not reflected in our government, right? Because like you said, in Hong Kong, they protested because they didn't want to have the candidates that, you know, the parties wanted to shove down their throats. So they protested saying, no, we want to be able to choose our own candidates. And that's something that I know different groups are working on. Maybe we'll have somebody on the show in the future to discuss campaign finance reform. But are there any statistics that show what kind of support there is for single-payer health care, you know, in general?
Well, I mean, Don Berwick ran for governor ran for the nomination for governor in Massachusetts, and he got 20% of the vote, and that was astounding because he wasn't known. He was not a politically known figure. He's well known in healthcare, but not in politics. He got 20%, and he got 20% because he was campaigning on single payer, and Massachusetts has already had a taste of what it's like to have close to universal healthcare. So I think that's the only figure I have. When you go around asking, though, it's like my Medicare question, you know, is that people have to understand what it means. If you ask people, would you like to have a card, like you said, like you have from Canada, well, all you do is give the card, and that's it. Would you like that? I think everyone would say yes. You
know? Right, right.
And that's the way to do it. That's the way to do it.
Sure, sure.
And it can be.
And we saw in Vermont as well, Governor Shumlin won the election.
He won the election on the base on it.
Single payer.
That's
and
right.
Of course, he
reneged.
He reneged, but he waited until after he was reelected on the issue before he reneged. And advocates are putting pressure on him now to hold a public meeting and be more involved. And
but
29 people were arrested. I think it was last week or the week before protesting the governor in the legislature because of the decision.
But, you know, we can end on this note, and it's where I began, is that and the 625,000 people in New York, in Vermont, that's a small state, they're going to spend the same amount of health care because everyone's going to get health care one way or the other, insured or uninsured, poorly insured or well insured. They're going to spend the same amount or more. It's just basically how it's going to be financed, how it's going to be organized, and how it's going to be delivered.
Right. The bottom line is we can do it
if
the political will is there. Thank you so much, Dr. Rigamer, for joining us today
on
WTUL New Orleans. This is 91.5. I'm going to pass the microphone back to my co-host, Nora. I also want to remind people that Healthcare Now is another single-payer advocacy organization that's out there, and you can find them on Facebook as well. Look up PNHP, Physicians for a National Health Plan. They have great stuff on their Facebook page. And so, Nora, we're going to run Democracy Now! As we always do at 9 o'clock on News and Views. But first, I think you have some announcements about the prison industrial complex calendar and events going on around town and entry points where people can get involved if they're interested in getting involved in justice issues. So.